50 right-wing pieces of legislation in 43 states. On the other hand, there's federal legislation that the Reverend Senator was talking about. This is something that we should all be involved with in terms of fighting for the right to vote. We've been doing the Election Crimes Bulletin on the Flashpoint Show with Greg for years now. And really, the vote is going to be crucial. We have seen an attempt to overthrow this government. We know that there's an anxious right wing that doesn't want the people out there calling the shots. So we have a big job ahead of us. Again, I thank Greg Palast. I thank Reverend Senator Raphael Warnock. I am glad that some extraordinary people are being elected to Congress, people who care. And that in itself is inspirational. Thank you for listening over Free Speech Pacifica.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs.
For this more is Granny D. Show, to listen I'm talking from KBOO, Portland. I come from Dublin, New Hampshire, and I go across the country working for public funding at the state level. And I often hear about KBOO on my email. It is often mentioned as one of the most progressive and daring stations that we have in this country. They are not afraid to tell you the truth. So tune in to KBOO Portland and get the real word. All you need is love.
Why do you love KBOO? Tell us what you most love about KBOO Community Radio, and we will use it on air during our next membership drive. Record a one-minute testimonial using the KBOO mobile app, or use a voice recording app on your phone and email it to info@kboo.org. That's info@kboo.org. Thank you.
Welcome to Art Talk Bus Stop, a monthly youth-centered podcast about how artists do their work and make a living. I'm Nicole Cabrera.
And I'm Erica Thomas. Today we're joined by William Reel. William works with other people's art and makes art, and he has a strong desire to one day visit outer space.
So, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Well, given that, William, do you want to tell us a little bit more about what you do for work and how you got into that line of work?
Sure. Yeah, I moved to Portland about 20 years ago, and my intention was to kind of work on houses because I'd never done that stuff before. I'd come through this part of the country at 2000, and I was like, saw Victorian houses. I thought, oh, that'd be awesome to go work on a Victorian house. And I ended up doing that, but that kind of work got me into the art museum, working there as a preparator, temporary preparator, when they opened up their new art wing. And from that, it was just kind of word of mouth, moving around to eventually working for RAC, Regional Arts and Culture Council, for 12 years. And now I'm fortunate enough to have been around long enough to work for private collectors and occasional installs in public and private locations.
Cool. So for some of our audience who might be young people that might not know what this means, what does a preparator do?
Yeah, I don't think I even knew what it was when I applied for it. So the preparator is basically the folks who paint the walls. They take, you know, if there's a exhibition with sculpture and painting, you know, things get delivered. You take them out of the crates. You put them on the walls. You work with registrars, curators, other staff of the institutions. And that's in the typical museum setting. So they do a lot of the heavy lifting delicate dancing around expensive objects.
You mentioned working with sort of private entities and people. What is that kind of like? How do you go about choosing who you work with?
A lot of the times, you know, in the beginning, it was like, I'll say yes to every job because it's like, as a freelance person, you're not really sure when the next one's going to come down the pipe. But nowadays, I try and hang as little art as I can. There was one example I used as a thing I don't want to do is I was in somebody's McMansion-ish type house, 15 feet up in socks on a ladder, installing a reproduction of Madonna's Ray of Light album cover. And there wasn't much to it that inspired me. And I was putting myself at risk, you know, lifting a heavy object on a ladder in a place I was just going to be for a couple hours. So I try and, you know, there's a lot of good people in the system that when someone's like, hey, this is a really cool person to work with, you should connect with them. And there's a lot of times where private collectors have really interesting collections, and so some personal interests play out there as well.
So sometimes you're choosing because the art that's owned in the collection is interesting to you.
Yeah, and or I mean, there's a good handful of people that I really like to work with. Just whatever the problem is, we're good heads that approach it and figure it out together and have a fun time figuring it out. Because that's the one unique thing about it is almost every installation is a different problem to be solved. And the reason why I get called often is somebody has this thing, they want it to be up there, they don't know how to make it happen. And either I or through a network of people, we make it happen.
When you do work with people and artists sometimes, how involved do you become with sort of creating the work? And what are some other roles that you have to play?
Kind of keeping time. You know, there's some artists who are pretty green to, say, public art, for example, and it's their first big one and they want to do it huge. And they maybe make smaller scaled stuff. A lot of times, and myself as an artist, I've gotten into this place too where I bit off way more than I could chew. And I'm often now as the collections person, the voice of reason to be like, hey, I know you want to make this 50-foot thing, but if we made it 12 feet, we could have it done by the opening of the building. And it's going to cost you this much. And you'll be actually able to pay yourself. Because a lot of artists, when they do public projects, they don't consider paying themselves. They just put all the money into the project. We all feel it's really important that you pay yourself for what you're doing.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Erica, I think you had a question about public spaces.
Nicole and I were talking about a lot of the things that you've done in the past, like the nightlights installations for RAC.
Oh, yeah.
And so it looks like a lot of your work has centered around sharing art with the public. What was interesting or important to you about working with art in public spaces?
Well, you get to interact with the public. I mean, that part, for better or worse, is pretty interesting. Because a lot of those sculptures, you can't, you know, pick up and move to a warehouse and work on it. You've got to do it out there in the public. And a lot of people have opinions about public art. So it was really curious because a lot of people I've worked with who do the cleanings and maintenance on sculptures, we've all been approached, and people assume that we're the artist who made that piece of art. And so they just started giving us a bunch of opinions. But it kind of proves itself, like, worth the public art, because right away you get into this conversation with these people about the art, but it just starts to spin off into kind of more interesting, more personal experiences that I found that to be pretty rewarding. And when I was working for RAC, there's a two-dimensional collection that cycles through all of the city and county buildings, and it was my job to kind of curate it and then install it in everything from the Juvenile Justice Center to the courthouse to the mayor's office to, you name it, health clinics. And that was a really rewarding part of that job because I got access to pretty much every aspect of a city through art. It was a pretty unique position to be in. And then I got to talk with people working there about their interests in art, and I could show them things that were available in the collection and then try and work it out to have the best stuff on the wall. Say, in a waiting room in a health clinic, you got to be really thoughtful thoughtful about what goes on the wall there. Those things were really enjoyable to talk about.
Do you ever encounter people who are like inside of those government institutions who are like not interested in the art and have to talk to them about like why you're doing what you're doing?
For sure. This makes me think of one piece in particular. It was a large abstract piece by, I can't remember who it was, but it was large and it didn't have any defining figurative features. It was probably 6 feet tall, 4 feet wide, and it was in the county commissioner's floor. They all are on the same top floor. And when I put it in, I remember people walking by like, oh no, I can't look at that every day when I come to work. Not, no way. And part of the public collection is, the intent is to rotate it around so that the public in all places get to see it. And so something like that will stay for a year, 6 months or a year, and then gets cycled out. Well, the same people that said, oh, no way, I can't ever look at that, when it came time for it to go, they're like, you can't take my, that's my work of art. Like, I look at that every day, and I think that, you know, they start to take some ownership over it in a really peculiar way. But for the most part, people are really appreciative that they get art on their walls, because a lot of them don't have a lot of experience around art other than going to an art museum or having their relatives' artwork hung in their house.
You mentioned coming over here to Oregon, Portland, and wanting to come and restore Victorian houses, but you became an installer. So how did that happen and where did that shift happen?
Well, I was always an artist. I went to college in New York for an art degree, and I was working in New York behind a desk, calling people to do all kinds of things, helping produce photo shoots. And I wanted to know how to do it myself, you know? Like, we had a shoot where we were having a wallpaper person come in, install wallpaper, or build a whole fake set, and I was like, I'd really love to know how to do that stuff. And I wanted to get out of New York, so I moved to Portland kind of on a whim, and it was a slow transition, because at that time, there wasn't a lot of opportunities that I knew for creative jobs, and that was just my lack of access to it. I started working for this place called Hollywood Lights, which is a theater and trade show lighting company, and that was actually an interesting, hard job with, you know, weird hours installing lights for concerts and auto shows and stuff like that. And then somebody I worked with said, hey, the museum's hiring a few people, what do you think? And I was like, yeah, I definitely want to give that a shot. The best part about the art world installation stuff is, it, like I said before, it's always changing. The parameters are always moving. People are always making stuff out of materials and in ways that are so different from what's been in the past.
Was there anything special that drew you to Portland? Because I often notice that people that come from out of state into Oregon are often like, well, I've heard about Portland. Was that something that you kept in mind, or were you just like, okay, Oregon, Portland, let's go?
I actually thought Eugene was going to be where I was going to land. The person I was with at the time, we moved out. We spent 6 days there. We ended up coming up to Portland 2 days, just like, hey, let's just see what that's like up there. And then we jumped ship and moved to Portland, and I think a week later had a house. And it was right after 9/11, so we had a little money saved with the intent to move. And it was a great time to live in Portland because it was pretty inexpensive. A lot of places were available. We actually had a house with a yard, which was so different from what we were used to in New York. And it was just, for me, it was a necessary move to something more natural. And once we started going out from the city, we realized, like, oh yeah, this is, I see why people live here.
Yeah. Kind of focusing on your work, I noticed it was very colorful, and just very interesting and really cool to look at, sort of in like 2010.
Thanks.
But as the years kind of progressed, I noticed that you focused more on like nature. How do you think that evolution happened?
That's interesting. You're right. I don't know that I made a conscious choice to steer away from human-centric stuff. I feel like it's kind of a natural trend a lot of us are going through right now. We're kind of inundated with so much human, mm-hmm. that escaping to something non-human is pretty essential. You know, in the history, there's been a lot of occasions where back to the land movements have taken place, or you know, setting up retreats in nature started becoming a popular thing. And for me, I think I was looking around. You know, a lot of my work personally, I used found materials, and in the last 2 years, I've probably used most of the things I've made are things I found in my yard, and most of that is trees, bushes, branches, you know, and a lot of garbage too. I don't know. It's a great place to explore. Like, it's unlimited. We're still, you know, we don't even know how many species of things there are on the planet, mm-hmm. and it's just amazing what we find.
Having looked at your art, I noticed that you document the work that you've done, and you've also done a little bit of sort of like the process of it. What were some of the stuff that you used to record it and upload it onto YouTube?
I'm a pretty basic guy, you know. I use my phone. I used to have a digital camera that I use all the time, but phones are so good now. You know, like even what we're doing here, the equipment we're using is some very accessible stuff. It seems to be getting easier and easier to make professional-looking things with, you know, non-professional equipment. Like, full movies are being recorded with iPhones, and you can't really tell unless someone tells you about it. Subject matter and the stuff I use, equipment, whether it's the art itself or the equipment to document it, is often whatever's around. I'm really a big advocate for not forcing yourself out of doing something because you think it's going to require this amount of money or this amount of stuff. Like, if you want to build a boat and float in the water, find some water jugs and like start gluing them together, or, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. there's so many ways to creatively achieve what you want to achieve, and I think art has been the venue for me to succeed, most of the time fail, but succeed at getting to those places, mm-hmm. and have fun with it.
Before I guess we technically started recording, you mentioned stories. Is that something you're able to talk to us about, or?
Yeah, it's part of a, I think for that, stories is a bar recording place that I made in my house. And COVID kind of inspired it, because going to a bar was a pretty common thing for a lot of people to, you know, after work, have a drink, start talking to people, tell a story. That place was eliminated, and that casual encounters with strangers, I mean, I don't know how people do it now. Maybe they meet each other in a Zoom class or something, but that's not my style. So, and I know there's a lot of people who have a lot of great stories unrelated to the pandemic, just in general. And I've heard a lot of great ones, and I would love to have people come and record them. So the intent there is just to hear good storytelling. There's not a specific goal about any specific subject. There's a whole section of things I've done public-wise. Like, I did an outdoor movie series at my house. I paired with local groups. They hosted it. They acted as the host. We had a live performance, Until the Sun Went Down, showed a movie, and had, you know, upwards to 150 people in attendance. And so it was a really great gathering place for a lot of people to meet. And that part I find really exciting. And the night lights component that you were talking about earlier, that kind of bled into the RAC funded, because RAC's right next to an empty parking lot. And so we did that for several years there, which was really well received by the public.
Can you just briefly describe like what Nightlights was, in case people don't know?
So Nightlights was a outdoor projection series that happened every first Thursday in coordination with the Pearl District First Thursday. And each month during the winter months, primarily because we needed the darkness during those hours to take place, artists were selected by a jury. They each received a stipend, and RAC provided the giant wall and the parking lot for them to project onto. And it was a partnership with Open Signal, which provided the equipment and a lot of great creative input. I don't know how many years we did that. I think it was like 3 or 4 years. And a lot of artists who wanted to, are video-based artists who would love a venue to that scale, because it's like a 3-story building that they were able to fill the whole building with. that gave them an opportunity to like think big and then work big, because for most part people either worked virtually, you know, in their computer screen or in a VR mode, and there was a really amazing variety of things that happened there. Erica, didn't you take part in one of those?
Yeah, I did actually. Renee Sills had that project. I think it was called something like How to Dance Like a Boss. Yeah, but I was, so she had this structure where like she invited a group of people who don't know how to dance, and I'm one of those people. and we were supposed to like lead the charge of getting a group of people in the public, in this public space, to do a dance with us that we were teaching them, but as amateurs. And so I did a voguing class.
Oh, yes. And I remember it raining pretty hard during that night.
It did rain, yeah, but it was like, I'm like, that's so dramatic, it's perfect. Anyway, that was really fun. I kind of want to ask you a little bit more about like the relationship between yourself as an artist and the job that you do. You said to me, my art is not career-based, so it's hard to define, but I explore mediums and subjects, don't usually stick with one for more than a few years. That's the luxury of not making art for a living. Which I think is has been a running theme with several of the artists who have day jobs who we've interviewed. Mm-hmm. So if I just wanted to ask you if you want to talk for a minute about making that choice to have like a quote unquote day job separately from your art practice.
So I've always had a day job, and because you know you're in school, you're learning about art. You get out of school, it's pretty rare that you're going to be making money right out of the gate with your art. And I think I came to, I was working so much that my art practice kind of just petered out to almost, you know, the can't imagine the candle going out and you just see the smoke going up. I didn't get to the smoke going up part. And that's part of the reason why I left RAC, because I was like, now is the point. I need to either eliminate it and go into arts management, or I need to continue the flame. And art's something that I'll always make my entire life. And I think at that point, I wasn't switching gears to try and make a living as an artist. I was just switching gears to accept that making art is going to always be there. And accepting that I'll have a day job and choosing to have ones that inspire the art that I make has been a luxury to be able to do this choosing. I think I kind of drifted away from your question, but I really do value the ability to work on some paintings and then be tired of that and totally throw them in the corner and go over here and start carving out a lino cut or something, you know, or mow my grass in a really bizarre way and consider that as part of my art practice. Like I don't have the confines of having to explain it continuously. And so it's become a little challenging to even describe it to myself. I just kind of leave it as I don't need to define it to myself. And mm-hmm. I hope that's not a cop-out.
No, I mean, I think what you're talking about is interesting because, you know, if you're assigning monetary value to the art projects you make or the pieces that you make, it does necessarily change how you have to go about making the work if it's a business. So like, I think those are kind of generally speaking the two tracks. It's like you either have to make, you know, you are a business owner and your art practice is your business, or you have another kind of business or way to make money or a job, and then you do whatever you want for your creative practice as like untethered from money. I've tried both things and they both have pros and cons. So
yeah,
you know. Yeah.
When I first moved here, I was selling art on the street at Last Thursday and First Thursdays. First Thursday was new to me, and I would bring these things that I made, whatever it was, and I would sell them. And it was great because I would try and trade with people and other artists, and they weren't interested in my work. And it was kind of comical because I would sell all my stuff and be like, okay, I'll buy your art now because you still have it there, and I sold all my stuff. But there was a point where I was like, oh, I know what I'll be able to sell. I'm going to make small paintings of fruit, and I'm just going to sell those, and it's going to be awesome. And it was the only time that I was like, I'm going to make this, and it's going to sell. And I didn't sell one single piece of fruit at all. And I had just thrown them all away, and it was like, okay, you went at it the wrong way. Like, the thing that made the art something for me was totally gone, and I was just making paintings of fruit. You know, there was no heart in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was definitely a good lesson learned, to, like, if you're going to do it for real.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You created this piece. It was one of my favorite ones that I saw of yours, which was called Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Oh, yeah.
I thought it was really cool, and I'm just curious, could you tell us sort of like what the mechanics and had how you had to go about making it in order to make it move? But first of all, actually, can you tell us like what it is for the people who may not have seen it?
Yeah, so there was a point, I think that was like 2007, 2009, there was like a downtown initiative to activate some empty storefronts, which is all over the country. There's great programs that utilize that venue. And if you're an artist and you are looking for a place to show installation stuff, find an empty storefront, find out who owns it, and just ask questions. And so in this particular case, it was like this domed stairwell that went underground right on Taylor and I don't remember the cross street was, but Director Park is right around the corner from there now. And I was like, this is such a cool little spot. Somebody should be doing some art in here. And what I ended up designing was this thing that hung from the top, and it had about, I think, 30 or 60, I don't remember how many there were, pieces of paper that I cut in different, I don't know what they look like gears, kind of. I don't know if you, what you think they looked like. It was like confetti that was still glued together mm-hmm. or something. And I had put motors in, interspersed at the top, so that when somebody walked by, it triggered an activated light sensor, and the motor started turning, and then all the paper started turning, and it kind of was this like shake of color. And the inspiration for that was the tourism factor of people walking around there, seeing something that was like, whoa, what is this? Started moving. But then there's also a lot of folks on the street who at odd hours of the day that I also thought could enjoy the experience as well. And I would go and visit it, and it totally, I saw people taking selfies in front of it. And then at some other occasion, I saw two guys just sitting back like, whoa, like totally enamored. I wanted to make something that could relate to the whole spectrum.
Is that why you called it Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds?
Yeah, I can't remember exactly why. I try not to get too conceptual with the titles and ideas. Mm-hmm. People end up calling me on it if I get too trying too hard. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to relate to as many people as I can with the stuff I make, because I, working in the public realm, I really see the value in that,
mm-hmm.
And I hate putting people out because they don't understand what they're looking at.
Mm-hmm. Do you have like a favorite piece that you've made? Like, what is the one that you're just the most proud of?
Huh. I thought you would ask me that question, and I didn't really think about the answer. No, I don't have a favorite. There's one installation I did that was called Lifeboat, that was a like 30 paper mache submarine style lifeboats that I hung from a space that I really enjoyed making those. I probably had like 10 or 12 people help me create that whole project. Took 3 to 4 months to make. That one execute, like my concept to final execution was probably the most connected. But the best part about any of those projects is the people I'm working with. And, you know, everybody volunteered because they didn't have any money to pay people, but people still came back the next day to like, hey, I'm ready to make some more, and I have some ideas on how they could be better. And I'm just like, this is wonderful, you know? Getting collaborators is definitely the best part about making art for me at this point. So, Nicole, are you going to school for art?
I'm studying multimedia right now.
Cool.
So I think I would say it's not similar to what you do, but I would say it's in the realm of what you do. So like, I want to become sort of like someone who is able to manage and oversee projects and be able to help out where I can help. Yeah.
What's great about getting to that position is you get to see what you do and don't want to do.
Yeah.
Like, if you find yourself really excited about budgets, mm-hmm. I mean, it's an easy way to find out, like, hey, I love doing budgets. And
yeah.
And if you want to be just management and not ever get your fingers wet, that's another great aspect, too. The preparator is definitely a hidden job. Mm-hmm. I didn't learn about it in art school. I never thought about it when I went to museums. I just figured the stuff was on the wall, and that's what it was. But there's so many other folks doing stuff behind the scenes. Conservators are a really amazing bunch. Often they're handed something that someone's like, hey, this is broken. Can you fix it? And it's either decomposed or broken beyond belief, but you know, it's their job to figure out how to make that work.
What advice do you have for just young people in the art world that you would give to them, whether as an artist or as someone who wants to like help them maybe think about a different path in the art world?
When you say different path, you mean like the other options that are out there?
Yeah, so like a conservator or like a someone who restores artwork or like you who does installations.
Yeah, like I found my path really, it just kind of happened. And I think it happened because I chose things that I was interested in. And there was definitely a lot of things I did that I went to work and I was like, oh gosh, I got to go to work and I don't want to go to work. But I still knew that what I was doing, I had a lot of respect for. And so I would say, you know, follow a path that is true to you. Because a lot of people that don't, like say your family members who don't really, they want you to be a doctor, a lawyer, or engineer or something that they can grab onto if they don't have a lot of knowledge around art. As an artist, you're going to have to do a lot of.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web? Well, you do now. Just type www.kboo.fm, click on Listen Live, and you've got us. Just another example of how